Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Well, good morning there, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how you doing?
I'm doing well. We have Lydia Bastianich coming on the show later. I'm very excited about that. She's one of my favorite food personalities, and she's a great cook, and we've been eating at our restaurants forever.
She's come out with a lovely Christmas book where she talks about...
Don't give it away! Don't give it away! We have to keep them listening!
She talks about the decorations.
We have to make them suffer through listening to us until Lydia Bastianich comes on the show.
She talks about putting things like hanging things from her Christmas tree, like tangerines and things like that. So in honor of that, I've brought the closest thing I had in my house for us to have for breakfast this morning.
Those are clementines.
They are clementines, but it's orangey fresh in here this morning, isn't it?
I love clementines.
They're like nature's perfect fruit.
And they're perfectly in season now. They're not local, though, I must say. But not everything can be local. I mean, you know what? You live in Jersey. What are you, never going to have citrus fruit again?
Right.
You know, I mean, there's certain things that just aren't local. Lemons. You know, balsamic vinegar and citrus.
Well, you could do what Susan Grant does at La Petraia in Italy.
Yeah.
You just make your own balsamic vinegar, and, you know, 8 years later, you're done.
Except it's not really balsamic vinegar.
Of course not.
So it's balsamic-esque vinegar. And I would like rather import Susan's from Italy.
That'd be
better. If you haven't listened to that show, go to La Petraia, P-E-T-R-A-I-A, show online. It's great remote show that we did from Italy this year. It's terrific. Want to talk about something a little more close to home? I know that you read the New York Times as well, and you saw the article on the mystery of the red bees.
I got to say this. It captured me. I'm pulling in the newspaper in the morning last week before, whatever it was. And front page is an article that's titled "The Mystery of the Red Bees." And I didn't know, were they angry?
It was the mystery of the red bees of Red Hook.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know what the deal was, but it's a really interesting story that tells you a lot about food.
Cherise Mayo was raising bees on Governor's Island and in Red Hook in Brooklyn. And she's, you know, like we are, she's into local organics, et cetera, and so forth. And her bees start coming back to the hive red in color.
Red.
And not just any old red, like bright, translucent red. And somebody said even at sunset, the bees seem to glow a little bit. Now, living near a nuclear power plant, that's...
Yeah, here in New Jersey, we get very concerned when things are...
Our mackerel. You can read by the light of a mackerel here in New Jersey. No, you really can't. I made that up. So anyway, the red bees, they're not red bees. They're bees that are red now, are coming back. And then the hive, the honey in the hive is turning red. What the hell is going on, right?
Well, they said so they come in, and the bees have begun to turn a little bit red. And now they start looking at the hives and the honey in the hives. And the honey in the hives is runny.
Right. It's not the right texture either.
And it's red in color, kind of this bright, unnatural red color.
And acquaintance, I'm reading from the article in the Times, an acquaintance only joking suggested the unthinkable. Maybe the bees were hitting the juice from the Maraschino cherry factory in Red Hook, Brooklyn on Dyckman Street. I didn't want to believe it, said Ms. Mayo. And sure enough, that's what was going on. They tested the honey, found it full of red dye number 4, high fructose corn syrup, laden red maraschino cherry juice is what was going into these honeybees.
So what's gone on here basically is the bees are addicted to maraschino honey juice.
Maraschino cherry juice.
Maraschino honey juice is what we would become addicted to if we continued this process one more step in its evolution.
Okay, listen, everybody. If you're not disturbed, you should be. Okay.
You're disturbed.
We are funny. We know that we prefer. Why do we? And the article talks a little bit about this. Why are we as humans? Why do we prefer cheese puffs to actual cheese? Why do we prefer maraschino cherry juice to a real cherry? It's because these foods have been designed to trick our bodies into thinking that something that's not good for it is good for it. And it works on such a basic level. I mean, I think there's a lesson to be learned here. This stuff is bad. Okay.
The idea is these are foods that your body, when we were hunters and gatherers, when we were hunters and gatherers, that your body would store as fat so you could use it later. Okay. Obviously, high fructose corn syrup didn't exist back then. But foods like this, foods that the sugar content was really high, where you could go. So our body craves those foods because it thinks we're going to store that energy and use it later, not store that energy and sit on the couch and watch, Monday Night Football.
Gunsmoke. Sorry, I'm showing my age. So but even more than that, I mean, more than what's worse about this than even high sugar foods. Our bodies are tricked into thinking it's the same as sugar instead of it being high fructose corn syrup and red dye number 4.
40.
Like it makes a difference. Like the 4 would be better, right? But so the bees are tricked as well. If the bees are tricked, son, you and I don't stand a chance. Okay? But what happened to the bees?
What you imply there is bees are smarter than we are.
Well, they should be better at finding nectar.
Appropriate food,
right?
The
nectar, right? So if it even fools the bees, we got no chance, right? Well, actually, unless we start listening to our head instead of the television commercial. And the honey was runny. It had changed the honey in texture. You are what you eat.
Mm-hmm.
Your bodily fluids are different when you eat maraschino cherry juice or any other dyes and stuff that does not occur in nature. It changes who you are, and your body is being tricked into thinking that it's something that's not. And the bees will create a honey that doesn't sustain the hive if you give them maraschino cherry juice. This is just a very basic lesson.
You want the irony?
What?
Her name's Cerise.
Yeah, it means cherry.
It means cherries.
In French.
Yet.
Yeah.
There are no cherries in the maraschino cherries.
It is just... it's an enigma wrapped in a mystery surrounded by an egg noodle. I don't know. So, I always forget the last part of that, so I just make something up. In a ravioli, you know? The mystery has been solved. So they find the beekeeper who's like, they go to the maraschino cherry factory, and he's like, they're like, well, will you do something about this? He's like, yeah, get your damn bees out of my cherry factory.
Like, I got a bee problem here. This is awful. So there are bees everywhere here.
The beekeeper got a cherry problem. The cherry people got a bee problem. So I think they're installing nets and hooks, and I don't know what they're doing. But there is a story. There's something really important here.
How are you
going to
catch a bee with a hook? That's how you're gonna do that.
Well, you would get a or much more difficult. You would get a ready for this.
That's gonna take a really long time. Bee at a time.
Hold on, strap in. Ready? What about a BB gun? Bing. All right, that's all. Eat real food. Thank you very much. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. And our guest today needs no introduction. You all know Lydia Bastianich. Lydia is a renowned chef and cookbook author. And her latest book is out just in time for Christmas. It's Nonna, Tell Me a Story by Lydia Bastianich.
Lydia Bastianich, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark Francis.
We're super excited to have you on this show, and I read this book. Actually, Mark read this book to his children this morning on the way to the studio. And I think people will be very surprised to see that you've written a children's book, I mean, for little kids.
We can't forget it has 15 recipes in the back, but, Mark, this is... It's my story. It's a real story. It's what I did as a child, and I shared it with my real grandchildren. And that's how the whole thing started. You know, food for me is telling stories, is life, is the story of people. In my case, the Italian people and the regionality of Italian people. But in this case, is about the Christmas tree that I made when I was a little girl, and it was all edible.
And the Christmas... And the Christmas tree you made as a little girl wasn't really a pine tree, right?
No. We used to go and the juniper berry bush. We used to have a lot of juniper berry bushes. And, you know, they're as tall as an adult, maybe 5 feet something. Not too big. You don't destroy a whole big tree. And it is beautiful blue. It smells wonderfully. It has even these little orangey berries when they're really ripe. So we used to even eat the berries of the juniper tree, mind you. But and it's nice and dense. And we used to put it on a table in the kitchen in a corner and decorate it with nuts, with oranges, tangerines, apples, little sickle pears. And then we baked. You know, we baked cookies, crostoli, all kinds of goodies. And we would tie it with a string or a nice bow that we had, ribbon that we had left. And we would decorate the whole tree, and the house smells delicious. It took about 3 weeks of preparation before the holidays, so it was an involvement of the whole family.
So I was really touched by the story, and obviously you were decorating the tree with these things, not because, you know, there was a department store in the area that you didn't feel like going to the sale for. This was out of a necessity, right?
Absolutely. It was what you had. You made the best with what you had. But, you know, when you look in retrospect, it was really being in harmony with the world around you, with, the elements, the food, and making the food festive for the holidays, you know, which desserts and cookies are. Decorating them. We had also, we made like the caramelle, the nougat, you know, and we would even tie that. We would buy caramelle, you know, those beautiful kind of wrapped in silver tins and all kinds of colors. And those we would tie up, but those were a treat because we went out to buy them. And, you know, we would even, when they were up, we would sneak some and eat the candy and put a pebble in it.
Yeah, that's my children are very excited to sneak the candy off of the tree and put pebbles in them. I want you to know that was definitely the favorite part of the story.
Well, they put the pebble pebble in it so that adults
still
don't know
like,
that you
right, still looks like
candy.
There's candy on the tree, but
yeah, because you know you got your let's say I don't know half a pound or a pound of candy they used to sell them by that, and you got I don't know 20 or 30 of these caramelle. And you didn't want to eat them because you wanted the beauty of the wrappers. You know, that was the kind of a decoration. And so you refilled it. But, you know, nobody knew. I mean, we weren't supposed to do that.
Lydia, your parents knew. Come on. They knew.
Of course they did. Of course they did.
But they had
was on top of my brother because he would get more, he would sneak more than I would.
You know, in the story of the Christmas tree, you talk about how you tell your modern grandchildren in America about this non-store-bought Christmas tradition, and they then seek to do that. And I think that's great. I think a lot of American families are looking to do stuff like that.
First thing my children said were, can we do this?
And
I mean, my kids range between 14 and 5, but first thing they said was, we want to do these things and put them on our tree.
You see, so you know what happens now at my house? I mean, you know, that's quite a few years ago, so, you know, you cannot live in that time. But, you know, the contemporary answer to this is that we have our Christmas tree, and it is as organic as possible. But what we also put is the history or of them today, like when they were in kindergarten, the first grade. You know, when they put their hands in the
paint.
Yeah, in the paint.
Yeah.
And then they do, or they put their hands in a piece of, in some cement, and then they frame it. You know, or they do all the cut out of, so all of these things, all the arts, that they did in kindergarten and so on that is saved through the years, we bring it all out and we make the tree so it reminds them of their history. So I think how is it relevant to today? I think it's a consciousness of not wasting, of rotating, of respecting food, making food the celebratory item rather than a piece of plastic, and make your own tradition. Now, you know, your kids want to do it, you have your own tradition. So go around and look at these arts and crafts that they do in school and hang it all up that represents them, you know, reflects them.
So your book, Lydia, is about how your grandchildren have discovered how you did things when you were a child. How did you react when you came, because you came to America as a young girl,
mm-hmm.
and so how did you react when you first saw the more commercialized store-bought ornaments
of today?
Oh, my
God, you know,
today?
I came here, I was 12.
Right.
So in every aspect, you know, you see all this beauty and bounty and things that I've never seen before. So our first Christmas tree, I remember, was one of these, wasn't even a real tree. You know, we were intrigued by it being this plastic tree. And on it, I remember we had, and silver and tinsel and everything that we didn't have. You know, this was a new discovery for us. So it was as plasticky as you could get.
Mm-hmm.
That was our first, and then we slowly, of course, went retro, we realized, you know. But we wanted to experience this because, you know, this is what is America. And so for me as a young child of 12 coming here was about exploring America and the customs that were here and what were these customs. And I'm going to be American and, you know, we're going to do exactly what's happening. So we really kind of catapulted in the other direction.
Lydia, I was a child of the 70s, so I had the fake tree, the plastic tree that we put in the box every year, took it apart, and we had,
yeah.
And I will never forget the ornaments that we had as a kid were plastic fruit. that was the ornaments that we put on. Plastic fruit. So the thought of putting actual tangerines on the tree was kind of appealing to me.
You have to feel good, Lydia, that you came to the country as a 12-year-old from those traditions, and you sort of embraced American traditions. But now here you are, taking Mark's family as an example, and with this book, you're having an effect on the culture here. I mean, that's got to make you feel great.
You know, this gratifies me ever so, because I am blessed with two of the biggest cultures, the most beautiful cultures in the world. You know, the Italian and the American. I mean, you know, you can't get any better than that. And, you know, I was given the opportunity to kind of pull them together.
Yeah,
I did it through food. So to share and to see that, you know, I am kind of making a difference and bringing those values, the beauty of my Italian culture, and that the Americans really want it. They love it. They love Italy. They love everything Italian. They want to incorporate it in theirs. So, yes, you're absolutely right. I'm blending in my own little way two great cultures affecting.
We have to take a quick break, and I do want to come back and talk about, you know, some of the other ways that you affect American culture, especially with your new project, Italy, which we've been to and heard so much about. But I just want to point out that the only thing that I can think of when we keep thinking of the juniper bush as the Christmas tree is I keep thinking it's the martini Christmas tree. It's a gin Christmas tree. It reminds me of a martini. Well, we're not going to do that in my family. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Lydia Bastianich. Nana Tell Me a Story is her new book. You can find out about it at restaurantguysradio.com. Stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Lydia Bastianich is our guest. We're talking about her new book, and we're talking about Italian-American culture, and we're thrilled to have you finally come on the show. And one of the things we really want to talk about is your new project in Manhattan. We actually make one of our many side gigs is public speaking, and we've been holding up Italy and what you and your son and Mario have done there as really culturally important. You know, coming together, and it talks about cultural importance of Italian American cuisine and authenticity. What are you doing in Italy? I thought your mission statement there was phenomenal.
You know, guys, I mean, I've been in, I came, as I said, as an immigrant of 12 in 71, opened my first restaurant. Food is my passion, and of course, Italian food. So I've been kind of communicating Italian food all these years. And I must say, in the beginning, it was, you know, America didn't know as much about Italy and Italian food. I didn't have the products here to really make Italian food or produce Italian food that is like in Italy. And in these sort of 30 years, I mean, many things have changed. And so have we with our restaurants, you know, became ever more authentic. We got all the products from Italy, got into the reality of Italian cooking, the originality of it. So, you know, we were kind of bringing the Italian, really the Italian table message and food message closer and closer to America. And, of course, Americans love Italian food now and really know a lot about it because of travel, because of writing, because of shows like yours. And I think that Italy was kind of the culmination. You know, guys, you kind of plan, you plan a restaurant, you have an idea, you have a menu, you have your chef, and so we were all our partners, and everybody had a lot to give, you know, to it, but you never know how the things kind of come together. Well, this came together as a bombshell. It was it is much bigger than we planned or anticipated. We were going to kind of work slowly at it. We wanted to bring Italy to New York. And I mean Italy with its food. So if you go to Italy, it's 50,000 square feet. It almost looks like three or four blocks of, let's say, in the center of Rome. And the food and the settings of that kind of feel. So that you come in there, you can have your little espresso, you can have a lavazza, you can have a gelato, in the really traditional Italian gelato, you can have a panini, we have a rosticceria, we have seven places that you can eat, and of course, the rest is retail that you can take home and cook at home. So it's kind of almost a social phenomenon, if you will. Yes, it is about the products. Yes, it is about the restaurants. But it also is very social. People gather. It is always full. They have a glass of wine. They talk. They walk around. They go to the bakery. You know, we have a wood-burning oven there. We have right next to it, there's another two wood-burning ovens where we have the pizza. We have pizzaiolis from Naples coming there. So, you know, I think our partner, Oscar Farinetti, whose idea is, and he opened the first store in Torino, made all of those little specialties of Italy accessible. And, you know, once Mario, myself, and Joe, you have that those products, then they become explosive, you know, and we had lots of fun. So it's a place, I think, beyond just eating and shopping. I think it's a strong cultural message, and also, you know, a message of the Italian way of living.
Well, we, Frantz and I, in that lecture that he was talking about, we gave a lecture talking about authenticity, and we used Italy as the example. But that's one of the ways it's authentic. In Europe, there's a conviviality, a socialness that happens in the streets that doesn't happen as much here in the United States.
Right.
And I really like that about Italy, that's something that you're trying to engender there, and at the same time bring real ingredients into the United States, because, you know, the authentic ingredients make the authentic food.
Exactly. You know, to transport a culinary culture, you need authentic ingredient, whatever that culture might be.
I think that you... go ahead. I'm sorry.
No.
I was going to say, I think that you would get a kick out of our lecture. Basically took the arc of authenticity from a one-way media environment of the 1970s and 80s to today, and we began with the Ragu spaghetti sauce commercial that ended with "That's Italian," and we ended with our segment on Italy, and as a real marker of where America's come as far as authenticity and really knowing about food.
Yeah, Americans are extremely educated. I had yesterday the assistant to the Minister of Agriculture of Italy, and he says, you know, we what can we do? I said, I said, the one thing you can do, you can continue. The Americans are eager to learn. They want to know. They're curious. You continue your source of information coming to America on the products, on everything Italian, because Americans are hungry for it. They love it.
Well, you're right.
But don't you, I mean, clearly you and your partners and your son are responsible for a lot of that culture coming to the United States. I mean, the ingredients in the United States, I mean, I look at our first restaurant opened in 1992, and I look at the availability of ingredients in this country versus what was available in 1992, and the difference is amazing, and I can't imagine that the difference isn't tenfold going back to 1971.
Absolutely. You know, I opened my first restaurant in 71, Italian restaurant. I couldn't get arborio rice, therefore, you know, making a risotto. I made a risotto with the long grain rice, but it was long grain, but it didn't come the same. So it absolutely is essential. No matter how good of a chef you are, unless you have that ingredient, it just doesn't happen. And then I think the second, if you will, almost phenomena is that people really got into local produce, they got into seasonal, and that's the way to cook. That's the way to eat. And, you know, you yourself, as well as I, we as chefs are the first kind of stepping stone into this movement towards, I am towards Italian, but I guess in your cuisine, to eating right and cooking right. You know, I think that the American table has been guided by big industry for such a long time. You know, the convenience of it, the economy of it, you know, but Americans are realizing that that's not good for them. And so that's great because, you know, we open the door and America follows.
And maybe the most important next step is to teach our children that. And Lydia's new book, Nonna, Tell Me a Story, can help in that. Lydia, thanks for coming on our show.
Thanks so much, Lydia.
Thanks. Let me just leave the website just in case
they
cannot get the book or whatever. It's www.lydiasitaly.com. It's L-I and no apostrophe, all one word.
And if you can't
if they have difficulties, they can get it there.
And if you can't find that, if you don't remember that, just go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, where you go to download the show, and we'll put a link up there as well.
Great. Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
So let's meet at Italy for un espresso, okay?
You can count on it.
We'll send you an email, and we'll be there.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody, it's Mark and Francis, the restaurant guys, Lydia Bastianich. Love her restaurants.
Right. I mean, you and I have been going to her restaurants literally as long as we know each other.
Oh, yeah, back to Felidia, the old days, but still.
Way back when we were in college, you're like, oh, I got an Italian restaurant for you, and you took me to Felidia, and you made me eat tripe.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm still mad at you for that.
You didn't even like it then.
I never cared for tripe.
Yeah, you know the only thing worse than eating tripe? Is being in the kitchen when they're
cooking
tripe.
When they're making
tripe in the afternoon.
I just can't.
The tripe, I can't really do it.
It is. It's on my list. You know,
although I felt bad about it as an Irishman until you couldn't eat it either. And I'm like, well, if he's not going to eat it, I don't have to eat it.
We opened Captain Lombardi. And so, it's an authentic Italian restaurant. I'm like, yeah, a lot of the food my grandmother cooked. Like, did your grandmother make tripe? I'm like, yeah, she did. So you guys make tripe? No.
When I was 7, I said, Grandma, I'm going to open a restaurant one day, and we're not going to serve that. We're going to serve everything else you make.
I really don't care for it.
Well, you know, I want to call people's attention to this video, which should be shortly be, you'll be able to link to it from Restaurant Guys Radio.
Yeah, a couple weeks.
We're going to put up, it's going to be several segments. It's a lecture we gave to the National Association of Environmental Managers, which is a pretty big organization of the top 500 or 600 companies in America. And it's their environmental officers. And we were asked to give a keynote address at their convention, which was really tremendous and a lot of fun.
It was great. It was a lot of fun.
We talk about authenticity and the Bastianich organization, and they're wonderful. Their core principles, I think, are core principles that are universal to a group, this emerging group of foodies that is moving.
Well, and what you realize, and you realize that there's a common thread that run through all of their restaurants, whether it's one of their restaurants by themselves or as partners, you see that same thread of authenticity runs through all of their restaurants, the top end to the more simple, you know, trattoria-esque restaurants. All of them have that running through it.
Well, and we should tell you about this book because Mark really did read it to his kids.
I swear to you, I read it to my kids this morning.
And the reaction was?
The reaction was they wanted to decorate the tree the way Lydia did.
It's a picture book, so it's for, you know, you can read it to little kids who can't read, or your kid is just reading, they can read it themselves.
Although I must admit, they said, can we still string popcorn and put that on the tree?
Well,
yeah, of course we can.
It's Italian American, you know, to be an amalgam. But it's a picture book, and there are also recipes in the back for cookies and things that you can hang on the tree.
You know, I do have one other little thing that... Mm-hmm. One of the things that Lydia has a recipe for in the book is pinoli cookies.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I have never gotten, my kids have never really had an affinity for pinoli cookies, because whenever pinoli cookies are out, there are other cookies out.
Right.
Well, I went to visit my mother this past Sunday, and as she has wont to do.
She made homemade pinolis.
She didn't, but she went to the pastry shop and got some cookies and things for us, and in the batch of cookies that I brought home with me, were some pinoli cookies. And all the kids were like, oh, you know, I've never tried the pinoli cookies, like I said, because there's always a smorgasbord of other chocolatey goodies
and
around.
And they look kind of nutty.
At the time, and they have nuts on them, and they're kind of... So this morning, three of my four children had their first pinoli cookie.
Oh, as an Italian-American, that must make put a tear to your eye.
It did, actually. I was like, do you know these nuts come from pine cones?
It's kind of like when the children in our family have their first Guinness Stout. It's very, very similar. Anyway, a funny story. I got a funny story from my Irish-American childhood, right? I'm in the second grade at St. Venantius Elementary School in Orange, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really use Ambisol in my family, right? So when you had a toothache or whatever, a little bit of whiskey on a Q-tip, a little shot of whiskey you put in your finger, it's fine, right? So you're laughing, right? My father was the local fire chief in the city of Orange, New Jersey. He was deputy chief at the time, and my mom was very involved in the school system. And it was a small school, and so I went up to the nun who was the teacher in the second grade, and I said, Sister Peter Thomas Marie, whoever you are, I said... You know, my tooth was hurting me, right? And I said, you got any whiskey? She thought it was the funniest thing she'd ever heard of. She's Irish, too, so she knew what I was... I said, she said, what? I said, my tooth hurts. I said, do you have any whiskey? She said, and because she wanted to keep the joke going, she said, Francis, I don't have any whiskey, but here's a pass. Why don't you go down to the school nurse and ask her if she has any whiskey? Also a friend of my mom. Went down to the school nurse. I said, excuse me, nurse, or whatever. You got any whiskey? Nurse called my mom and said, your son has a problem.
And I want you to know that Francis carries that tradition wherever he goes now. So wherever he goes now, he's like, got any whiskey?
Invite me over your house, even when my tooth doesn't hurt. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this last hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.